Thanks, David, and thanks to the Aeronautical Society for hosting this. I think you're probably all aware that this is a bit of a prelude to what's going to be the Future Combat Air and Space Summit from the 21st to the 23rd of May, which I know following this evening, you're all going to go away and promote wildly so that we have this theatre absolutely packed to the gunwales. I think it should be a good event. A great pleasure and a privilege to be able to do this as part of that prelude. As David's just said, this is going to be a podcast that we record here, so the first bit of the session is going to be on the record, but we will make absolutely sure that we save some time at the end, 15, 20 minutes or so, for Q&A, and that's off the record, so save your really testy questions for that part. You know, the old cliche about policemen look young as you get older. So I guess it says something when the chief of the air staff starts to look really young, which he does and always has. I've known him for a long time. When I was AOC one group back in the day, he just became a group captain on COS support staff. We had an away day. We were trying to turn one group stations from being competitors with each other into being a team and sharing ideas and working together. And Rich came and stood in for COS support on this Project Panther, as we called it at the day. And I have to say, just blew everybody's socks off with his knowledge, his wherewithal, and his ability to see not only what was going on the engineering support side, but was how it applied across the Air Force and in particular to my group. So I wasn't even vaguely surprised to watch him go rocketing up the system and eventually become the chief of the air staff through a number of seriously important jobs, not least director of air plans, the assistant chief of the air staff, the man running Finn Mill CAP for the Air Force, for the military, before becoming, of course, DCOM capability, and then chief of the air staff last year. And what an amazing journey that's been, and indeed what incredible changes we've seen since he took over that job just prior to RIAT. He shares with me a passion for flying, which is absolutely brilliant, and just telling me that he qualified over the Easter weekend again to fly Tiger Moths, so I'm looking forward to seeing him in the air. But I guess we've got to get down to business and not just yarn. So, from the Munich Security Conference this year to everything that we're seeing daily in the media, in the press, listening to on the radio, we have a pretty testy, worrying, challenging, risky geopolitical scene. Lots of people in the trade are talking about the need for us to be able to prepare for war. In the Pentagon, they're talking about the potential for a war with China in 2027. Some in the United States Air Force are talking about the need to go to war earlier than that in 2025. We've got what's going on over in Ukraine to watch, and have to say right now, not looking too pretty in terms of the Ukrainian defense. And that, in turn, brings around a serious worry about what Russia would do if it got the upper hand in that part of the world, and particularly if you're one of the NATO allies with a common border with Russia, or one of the former Baltic states. That is seriously concerning to them. But it doesn't stop there, does it? As we all know, what's going on in the Middle East right now has got massive, massive scope for escalation. Iran showing its knuckles quite regularly. And then we look into Africa and you see what's going on in Sudan and the horrors in that part of the world. This is a very, very dodgy geopolitical time. And the chief's phrase, since he took over, it seems to me, has been all about be prepared to fly, fight, and win, which is really, really important. But, Rich, then, question one. So, how do you feel that effort of yours is going? Is there the moral preparedness? Are we ready to go to war soon, if necessary?
As you said, my focus since I took over has been on making sure the Air Force is ready to fly and fight. That's what we exist for, that's why there is an Air Force, that's why there's a Royal Air Force. And if you look at, well, CDS last year at RIAT said that the Royal Air Force was the most operationally and globally employed of all of the services. And if you think about the 10 months and 9 days since I took over, not that I'm counting, if you took that 10 months since I've taken over, where the Air Force has been asked to step up and do something, we have done so. If you look at our readiness to take the fight to the Houthis, who are illegally trying to restrict international trade through international waters, the Air Force was ready to go and do that. When the Air Force has been asked last year to go and support the extraction of entitled people from Sudan, we were ready to do that. So I have every confidence in the Royal Air Force's ability to react to and respond to the demands that are placed on us by the government. But as you pointed out, the world is really quite a dangerous place. The potential challenges in the future are really very significant. And so whilst I do think that we have the moral component, the capacity, the capability in our aircraft and the phenomenal capability in our people, we can't be complacent. The world around us is becoming more challenging. Our adversaries, potential adversaries, are becoming more skilled, more capable. And so we have to adapt as well. And alongside that readiness to fly and fight has got to be a really important piece of work to get the most out of the investment that's been made in the Air Force over the last two decades in particular, but also to make sure that we are able to adapt that capability to meet that changing threat. And again, very impressive track record in terms of our innovative ability as an Air Force over many decades, but particularly over the last few years with the creation of the Rapid Capabilities Office. And there's a real clear appetite amongst the Air Force and its leadership and its people to adapt to that kind of threat. So, yes, I do think we're ready to fly and fight, but equally I'm not complacent about some of the challenges and risks that we face, and I need to improve, I need to adapt to be ready for the future as well.
The things that we've had to step up to recently have been really a follow-on from the sort of things that the Air Force has been doing over a number of years now. But really, people are talking about peer-to-peer conflict here, state-on-state, high-intensity warfare, which is, as we all know, a very, very different game. How do you feel about that, if it's Russia, if it's involvement somewhere in the Indo-Pacific? As I say, this is a different ball of wax altogether. We've seen the bear perhaps didn't have as sharp teeth and claws as we thought, but what are we learning and are we ready for that style of conflict?
I was over in Ramstein last Wednesday, with the NATO Air Chiefs conference, and that was absolutely the heart of that conversation, and a recognition that air power and space power, but air power is absolutely at the heart of the deterrent effect. And with that comes a requirement for us to demonstrate that we can fight and win in that kind of theatre. If you look at the situation that NATO air forces find themselves in, within the next few years, we will have over 600 F-35s in NATO in Europe. Fewer than 10% of those will be US. The rest of it will be from other nations in NATO. The F-35 is a world-beating capability in that task of suppression of enemy air defences and destruction of enemy air defences, SEAD and DEAD. And alongside the fourth-generation capabilities, our ISR capabilities, integration with space, that will provide us with the capability that we need to be able to face up to a threat from Russia. At a strategic level, NATO is, I think the economy is something like 12 times bigger. We've got three times the size of population just in Europe. So we have a number of strategic advantages. But what we do know is that Russia, despite its pretty hapless performance in the early days in Ukraine, is learning rapidly from the experience it's gaining in Ukraine. And we know that the cycle time of measure, countermeasure, countermeasure is shrinking really quite rapidly. And whilst much of the Russian army has been destroyed in Ukraine, Russian Air Force is largely intact, particularly its fast jets, long-range aviation. Although they're burning down their stockpiles of cruise missiles, that they still represent a really credible threat. So the focus for us in Europe through the NATO air chiefs and General Scorch Hecker, they have great names, the Americans, don't they? Jim Scorch Hecker, I'm just rich. But Scorch's priorities start with countering anti-access area denial, talk about integrated air and missile defence, talks about the command and control that comes with that and the need for us to integrate those things together. And so there is definitely more we need to do as NATO air forces, as NATO air chiefs, and we need to be preparing ourselves for that fight that might come. Because by doing that, that's how we deter Russia. And fundamentally, we don't want to get into the fight. We want to deter Russia by demonstrating the strength that we have and demonstrating that we can deny Russia the opportunity to target us and attack us. But there are definite areas where we need to enhance our capability, enhance our training, enhance our stockpiles, and develop some of that, things like integrated air and missile defence that our Defence Command paper refresh pointed out is the threat from air attack is at the most acute for 30 years. So there are a range of things we need to do, but I remain confident in NATO's ability to do that, but we can't stand still.
So there's a couple of ways we could go from there, but let's take peer-to-peer and say it's China. Heaven forfend that something happens in the Indo-Pacific. There are many who think that actually the Chinese will continue to use celestial calendars and find other ways to retake Taiwan or integrate Taiwan, but there are a number of people who think there's going to be a war over it. And if we need to do that, what have we learned from exercises like Northern Edge about a preparedness to be able to do it?
I think I'm on record as saying this, that the advantage that we have in the air domain is that the operational challenges, the mission sets that we have to achieve in an environment that in the South China Sea or in the Euro-Atlantic are very similar. So you have to take down and break into the anti-access area denial capability of your adversary. Therefore, you need to be able to deliver on the SEAD and DEAD mission. You need to be able to take down the high-value assets that your adversaries have. And so that mission set is very similar, whether you're in the Euro-Atlantic or whether you're in the South China Sea. So from an air power perspective, it's quite common skills. The real challenge in the South China Sea is the tyranny of distance. And when you speak to the US Air Force, who are clearly thinking very carefully on this, about this, is that one of their biggest challenges is how do you get enough fuel in the air? How do you protect the high-value assets that you need, whether that be your airborne early warning aircraft or your tankers or your SIGINT platforms? And that is the sort of challenge that we will face. But if you go to Red Flag now, you go to Northern Edge in Alaska, that the scenarios are based around the kind of threats that we would see in a South China context. And so we are working alongside our closest ally in the United States Air Force to develop those skills, to develop those tactics, and to think about how, if necessary, called upon, and clearly it would be a political decision, but how we would support the United States Air Force and our allies in that region should we need to.
There's always rumours kiting about that we might switch our F-35 by to have a mixed B and A fleet in order to be able to go further. Any thoughts on that?
The program of record, as the Americans would call it right now, is for us to grow from 48 to 74 F-35s, and they're all Bs. And that's the program record, and that's the program that we're working to. But you're right, there are advantages in F-35A, particularly actually out with the operational context, in the sense of F-35As on the operational conversion unit might offer some opportunities to free up F-35Bs to get them to the front line faster. F-35A has a longer design life, and so there are a number of advantages, and we would always keep those kind of things under review. But right now, the programme of record is for us to the next batch to be all F-35B.
Okay. And how about our space capabilities? What is, if you like, the UK's contribution to the American dominance in that particular environment, and what's lacking in that contribution that we can fix in order to be ready for peer-to-peer conflict?
Yeah. So geography, really helpful in the UK. But more seriously, if you look at the defence space strategy, that was Harv Smith and the team working for me developing that when I was in the MilCap job a couple of years ago. That really does lay out the priorities that we have and the approach that we were going to take. So our on-orbit capability as a country right now is really modest. I mean, it's Skynet, fundamentally. But what the last few years, and actually particularly the war in Ukraine, has demonstrated is the importance of space as a domain, both contested domain, but also a domain that supports the conventional fight on land, sea, and air. And the funding that was put in place as part of the 2020-2021 integrated review was to enable us to develop a number of operational capability demonstrators to allow us in the middle of this decade to make a choice about exactly where we would go. We know that space domain awareness is absolutely fundamental to the first challenge of securing our assets in space. Beyond that, understanding how we might contribute to an international space capability through, for example, on-orbit ISR capability, whether that be electro-optic, whether that be synthetic aperture radar, those are where our operational capability demonstrators are looking. I would like to see the evidence before we commit to one thing or another, but I think it's likely that the UK will end up with a low Earth orbit constellation of some description in the next few years. And that, alongside our allies and the benefits in terms of resilience that come from other nations providing information and intelligence into the international network, will help us be more confident about our ability to deliver effects in and through space as a consequence.
The speed with which the civilian sector was able to come to the aid of Ukraine, quite frankly, with Starlink, was quite phenomenal, frankly. Also impressive has been the ability of industry to turn its hand to generating these tiny but incredibly powerful fleets of drones. And a week or so ago, I heard you at RUSI launch the Autonomous Collaborative Platform strategy. Is that, if you like, the harbinger for the United Kingdom having that sort of capability to hand rapidly, and will it be capable of operating in a peer-to-peer environment?
Let me just go back to the space question you asked. So you're right, Elon Musk's Starlink, 20,000 terminals cobbled together through various places donated to Ukraine, have played a really important part in the ability of Ukraine to connect and to share information. But it's not been entirely plain sailing. And I think we need to think very carefully if we want to, as a nation, outsource all of our space assets to the commercial sector. because we well publicised examples of Mr Musk deciding to turn off elements of it. So I still think there is a place for sovereign military capability on orbit. Skynet is our geostationary system. What we could imagine a scenario in which you might bolster that with civilian constellations. And I do think space particularly offers us opportunities in terms of dual-use technology. And again, when we think about the resilience of space, being able to marry up the commercial with the military to offer alternative pathways and to make the complications of our adversary or complicate the judgments of adversaries, that is part of it. So I think there will be a mix of commercial and military on-orbit capability. I don't think it'll all be civilian. I don't think it'll all be military. It'll be a balance between the two. So I just wanted to bring that out. On your point about ACPs, yeah. Autonomous Collaborative Platforms, drones, let's just call them drones, it's a lot easier. The short answer is yes, that they absolutely will play a part in peer-to-peer conflict. For those of you who were unable to hear my speech at the RUSI week before before Easter, I laid out a range of perspectives on combat air, but made the point that it's clear to us from the analysis we've done, the operational analysis, through the work we've done through the Lanka and Mosquito programs, that there is definitely a place for autonomous platforms in the future combat air mix. Our judgment and our analysis so far suggests that if you think of it in three tiers, tier three being highly survivable autonomous systems that you can't afford to lose and which, you know, if you lost, would fundamentally change the way you fight, down to relatively cheap thousands of pound drones in tier one, which are we don't expect to come back, they're disposable. There is unquestionably in that cost-benefit curve benefit in our analysis from that tier one capability. And as I said week before last, is that I expect us to deliver a usable operational capability with autonomous collaborative platforms within the next year. They will work with our current platforms and be focused principally on supporting us in the counter A2AD, the anti-access area denial mission set that we've got. And that is definitely around a peer-to-peer conflict. As our technology evolves, as our thinking develops and prices reduce, I think the tier two type capability will find a place in that force mix, what we describe as buying its way into it, where the value for money case makes it worthwhile. I was very honest in the presentation I gave the other week, is that, you know, I've got funding and people to deliver a tier one ACP capability and to sustain it and use it. But beyond that, we will need to make adjustments to the program in order to find the headroom to be able to invest in those things. And that those judgments are the tough ones. Is I can always come up with reasons to spend more money. It's whatever the budget is working out what that relative priority is. So that value for money curve is really, really important.
Of course. And it brings us on nicely, doesn't it, to Tempest, the Global Combat Air Programme, which is going to rely on elements of the ACP for its success. And itself is really a pretty demanding programme set against demanding timelines. Please talk a bit about that and your confidence in being able to deliver to that. And if I can just tease you a bit, why in this day and age when we're preparing potentially for war, do you think it's right to have the next generation combat aircraft program in the States, FCAS as they call it over in Europe? Shouldn't we be getting our heads together on this?
If you look at the Future Combat Air Strategy that was published in 2018, on the page two there, you can see the four criteria that matter in terms of what a future combat air strategy and a future combat air program would deliver. It's firstly, military capability. Secondly, it's about strategic relationships. Thirdly, it's about budget. And fourthly, it's about industrial capacity and capability. So the project and program is not just about delivering military capability. It's about all of those things. And we have to find a mechanism and a set of partners where our requirements, our industry, and our timelines are sufficiently aligned for us to be able to develop that program. And where we can get the benefit industrially, get the benefit from the savings that come with doing it with other countries, and get the benefits of the strategic relationships that it builds. And so for now, I think it's perfectly reasonable to see why we've got NGAD in the US, SCAF in Europe, and then you've got this UK, Italy, Japan project under GCAP. And I think from a UK standpoint, from a military standpoint, it is an enormously positive story. In terms of confidence, I'm not sure it's really understood just how phenomenal the progress has been. I mean, just getting to the signing of the treaty after a relatively short period of time across three nations for a multi-billion pound programme is really, truly remarkable. And I know we've got some of the industry leadership in the room tonight, and the team in the Ministry of Defence have been amazing. The investment that the UK chose to make after the 2015 Defence Review was specifically to ensure that we had the skills and technology to be able to pull into an international programme. And that's really paid dividends right now, and that gives us a head start. But delivering a programme by 2035 is not straightforward, and that will require us to do things differently. It requires us to rely heavily on model-based systems engineering, end-to-end digital design and operation of the platform. But we've seen examples, B-21 in the US, where we've seen how that has accelerated the timelines that we've had previously. There's a huge amount of work being done to understand how that international construct will work, to remove some of the frictions that we've seen in traditional models like we had it in NETMA. And I have never been involved in a program that's been over such a long period, you know, over multiple years, where the drive and determination of all the partners in industry and in government and in each country has been so great to try to deliver that target. And so that gives me a lot of confidence that we'll be able to do that. But I am by no means imagining it's going to be easy.
No, I bet not. And right now, CS, you're sitting with a fabulous air inventory. Mm. And you've got that programme coming in, hopefully in 2035. But it seems to those who sort of look at the forensics of this, you haven't got much money for other things in the middle. So do we sort of fall off a bit of a cliff edge in terms of capability development for the Air Force?
So one of the things that I say is that if you look at where we are today in 2024, we're fortunate in the Air Force to have been through the most remarkable period of recapitalisation. Pretty much everything we operate, I put aside helicopters, which sit within the land command from my perspective, but pretty much everything we operate is relatively new. It's come into service and it reached its operational capability in the last few years. It's F-35, Typhoon Tranche 3, P-8, even the likes of Voyager, E-7 will come in soon, Protector will come in soon. So we're very fortunate in the position we're in, and we've benefited from a significant investment over the last decade in air capability. As we look forward, you know, from 2025, pretty much everything we've got in service will be what we'll fight with over the following 15 years or so, maybe longer. There is still more investment going in. So Radar 2 on Typhoon is a really significant investment and a massive enhancement to the capability. Very important in terms of our fifth-gen F-35, fourth-gen Typhoon mix, adding in that electronic attack capability that it brings. But also the continued investment to grow the F-35 fleet. So when journalists say to me, so do you need to spend more money on the Air Force and do you need to get bigger? I say yes, and that's exactly what is happening. But I am conscious that in the context that are described, and you described in your first question, where our adversaries are getting more advanced, they're developing their capabilities, that we need to do the same. And there's two challenges that I've set myself in the Air Force. The first is, how do we get more out of that investment that taxpayers made in air capability? And secondly, how do we take that as core capability and evolve it and develop it by the application of technology, which largely already exists? For what it's worth, there are a number of, alongside space, there are three areas of technology which I think will enable us to enhance that capability that we've got. The first is digital, and how we apply digital tools and how we apply digital technology to enhance the capability we've already got. The second is around synthetics. How do we involve and develop our training using the synthetic environment? And the third is around robotics and automated systems, the autonomous collaborative platforms that I describe. And those technologies enable us to get more capability out of the platforms that we've invested in. And that's what ACP is doing. Now, what I want to ensure is that as the defence budget rises to 2.5%, I'm clear about how we can enhance that capability for relatively modest investment. So that can be considered as part of the alongside defence's wider investments. But equally, we just simply need to get more output from the capability we've got. If you think about what's happened over the most of my career, but certainly over the last 25 years, is that we've sought quite rightly to drive more efficiency into our systems, to outsource more to industry, to consolidate around a smaller number of bases, to improve efficiencies through economies of scale. But those changes may not be, and in fact are not in some circumstances, best suited to the kind of operating environment we face in the future. But it does mean there's latent capacity and capability in our force. And targeted investment around people, targeted investment around spares can see us generate more capability. And so I want to be able to offer that choice to CDS and to governments to think about how they might want to think about investment in defence over the next 5-10 years and demonstrate the Air Force can really make a difference and deliver more without having to invest in new platforms or in new programmes.
You mentioned people in there, and of course we've all seen in the media over recent months the challenges faced by all services in the United Kingdom in recruiting and retaining people. And yet you want more from them, you want them to be more technologically capable, you want them to be able to absorb digitization, to be able to shift towards using synthetic environments. How are we going to tackle the difficulty with recruiting and, importantly, retention? I saw some figures relatively recently which indicated we were losing, or the size of the Air Force was decreasing about 100 a month. I don't know if that's an accurate figure. But if so, that's a pretty stunning decrease in capability.
I mean, just to your first point. So this is not about asking our people to work harder in terms of generating more. This is about changing gear. It's not about pedaling faster. It's about how do we change gear? How do we exploit technology, but how do we focus on the things that are going to make the most difference to deliver more outputs from the capability asset we've got, and ideally to actually ease the burden on our people. But your point about workforce is well made. The thing that I worry about more than anything else is the people, is my people, and it is about the workforce. It's a combination of things that have led us to a declining situation, as you're seeing right across the armed services. Some of it is delayed exits of people from COVID as a consequence of COVID. So exit rates dropped considerably in 2020 and 2021, and they've risen since then. In terms of the environment outside of the Air Force, a year ago there were 1.3 million job vacancies. The demand for disciplined, organised, technically proficient, competent, reliable people, kind of people we employ, is really, really strong. Wage growth in the private sector has unquestionably gone up faster than it has, has been greater than it has been in the public sector. So all of those are factors. And so we have to address some of those, and the pay settlement last year has done that to some extent. But I'm really clear that we're about being ready to fly and fight. And what we do in the Air Force is more important now than it has been for a long time. And it's certainly more important than a whole bunch of jobs that you might go and do in the private sector. And we all join for different reasons, all of us do, but all of us to some extent want to serve. And they want to protect our country, our families, and our interests around the world. So being clear on our purpose, and then a whole range of factors around how do we retain people. So making sure that it's clear we value people, sorting out terms and conditions of service, dealing with some of the irritants around infrastructure, around some of the bureaucracy that we face. And then on a recruitment side, it's continuing to enhance the work to attract people to the Air Force, particularly the armed forces more generally. And we've seen real uptick in the numbers of people and expressions of interest over the last few months compared to last year. Then we've got to improve the conversion rate of people who expressions of interest of getting them into training. And then when we get them into training, we've got to get them through really quickly. And we're seeing real progress on a whole bunch of those things. And you've seen some of the reporting in the press around some of the medical standards and requirements and trying to cut some of those away. But I'm also really pleased to talk about the phenomenal shift that's happened in the last year and a half in terms of our flying training system. So I was at Cranwell in February, sat next to the sword winner, and he will start his flying training in July. And if he goes fast jet, he will fly all the way through. Fastest we have seen people go through the training for a decade or more. And then we'll get them out to the front line as quickly as possible. So all of those things are factors. But
dare
it is the
I
issue
challenge
that
you, though, on, if you like, the offer. When Rick Haythornthwaite wrote that, I thought, incredible review last summer, it really knocked people back on their heels somewhat. And he was very clear. Do not cherry pick this.
Yes.
This has to be done as a one-er. And yet it seems to me that we've not yet really been able to tackle it as a whole, and we have started to cherry pick, and you are faced with the significant outflow that you've got today. What are we going to do to change that offer?
So I don't think it's
make
fair.
It contemporary.
Yeah, so I don't think it's fair to say that we're cherry picking, but you can't eat the elephant all at once. You've got to do it in bite-sized chunks, and so there's a degree of sequencing. And so, for example, one of the early areas of focus for the department and the services is engineers, because that's a particular problem right across the three services for some of the reasons that I described, and really focusing on things like delinking rank and pay, paying people for specialist skills that they bring. And that, actually, I think will be a really good pipe cleaner for a whole bunch of work that Rick laid out in his report. But anybody who tells you there is some kind of silver bullet, a magic wand that you can wave over this, which is kind of what Rick's paper said, there is no single thing that you can do. But it's fundamentally about how individuals feel about their organisation and about the value that they feel they bring to the organisation. And what I say to, when I go all over the Air Force talking to people, is we retain our people one person at a time. And all of us at every level have got a job to do to try to ensure that those people who work for them, who look up to them, feel valued and feel part of something bigger than just themselves. And I'm pleased to say that people in the organisation respond well to that. But I won't deny that this is a real, real challenge for us, and we've got to work at all of those things that are push factors or pull factors to make sure that we get the balance right. Many of the pull factors as we can to keep them in and minimise the push factors that lead people to leave. And that's going to be my job and my successor's job to make that work and to get the Air Force to pull up, level off and climb back up to the number that they need.
Sounds fantastic. And do you think that the country is going to provide enough people with a technological savvy in order to fill that requirement?
So I genuinely believe that there are enough people in the UK who want to join, who we can train and develop. I think that...
With the skill sets.
So the skills, I think, to some extent, we can train ourselves. So we have world-class training in the Air Force. Apprentice scheme across defence, I think, is the largest in the UK. And we have a long history in the armed forces of giving people the skills they need. It might be that we see in the longer term a shift away from people doing or an expectation people doing full careers in the armed forces, and they might do a shorter period of time, but we keep them in the enterprise. And one of Rick's the Haythornthwaite reports ideas was around these zigzag careers where people mm-hmm. come in to the armed forces, go back into industry and come back in again. So I'm confident about our ability to attract enough people, and I am confident that we can give them the skills. We may not recruit them with the skills when they come in, but that's fine. That's a model that we have used for many, many decades, right from the very start of the Air Force in 1918.
And dare I say, if you do the zigs, the people in this room are going to take the zags.